back, everybody. This is to DPIY, the show where DIY is not what we're good at, but it is how we make our podcast. I'm Jake, and with me is my co-host, Mr. Verano.
How's it going, everybody? And by that, I mean the few listeners we have. Thank you. Please pass the word still.
So to start out with, we have our opening, current event topics type things. First off, last time we had spoken about the Black Adam trailer that is out there.
I saw it. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I finally saw it. I hadn't seen it by the time of last recording, but I finally looked it up and took a look, and it does look pretty epic. And even if it isn't, it still looks like a pretty fun movie because, you know, we live in an age of fast food cinema, and people are fooling themselves if they think this is the stuff we watch is excellent, but this one looks like it's going to be pretty fun.
I agree. I think it will be, actually. The Rock really has been working for a long time to get the movie, and he's in amazing shape for it. Did you finally finish watching Obi-Wan?
I did. I think that one might have been as hypo. I might have accidentally kept that one on after. I think we already talked about it, but I liked Obi-Wan because of how it I like a lot of the stuff that they're doing in Star Wars now, where they're just continuing to help build the universe that they pretty much shat on when they took all the extended universe stuff from the past and said that is no longer canon, that is now old legend, and we will decide on what the extended universe is. And I guess it's cool. Now we're getting to see what that extended universe is. And so I liked Obi-Wan because it gave us some perspective on sort of what is going on in other movies. You know, how does she know to turn to Obi-Wan when she's in trouble in A New Hope, for example?
Yeah, I actually always wondered that from the old movies. I was like, I assumed there was something there, but it was like, why is it so specific to just him? Also, not paying attention that technically he was the only Jedi left around.
Well, but everything else is established. He's not exactly the only one, but everyone, like, it's like anywhere. Well, you know, there are other outlaw Jedi too, but they're all being hunted, and he can only do what he can only do what he can.
Yeah, that's true. Do you actually finally finish watching Ms. Marvel?
No, I
damn it,
I have it downloaded. I have not actually been able to watch it. I think I tried to start something and then I, you know, life with kids, I fell asleep.
I think it's only 5 episodes. It's good though. Does give its own backstory to the part of the character and extended family, which is cool.
Well, I do know the overall twist and how it what it does for the status quo, and I just considering how long many people have waited. Like, I don't know. It was kind of sucks that it was so easy to figure out the twist when reporting on it happened, because they were like, "Oh, just shitty headlining."
Yeah.
But anyway.
I did watch a bit of The Flash season 8. Is that the latest one?
That is, I mean, that's the latest one on Netflix. I liked it.
I saw the first 3 episodes. And
see, you're in the part that was eh.
Yeah, I thought it was okay.
See, the thing is, the first 5 episodes are the crossover for the season. But the thing about that crossover was it was filmed during the pandemic, so a lot of pandemic things are in place, so it doesn't even seem like a crossover. It just seems like 5 Flash episodes where they tried to cram in 5 guest appearances that don't really connect. It just the crossover isn't, it's probably not the best crossover, But once you get past that, there are some really good Flash storylines where they kind of what they instead of since they had less episodes from the crossover, they kind of just did a season where it's a few different compact stories thrown into one season, and they all kind of tie up loose ends in the end. So it's I think it was pretty well written and pretty well done, except for that crossover and Osric Chow trying to be like, oh, my boy Chester, and his wasn't the fault of his acting. He was just given bad direction and bad writing for his character in that crossover.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I only got to like episode three, so I still need to finish watching the rest of it. But from what it was, like, yeah, it was nice crossing over certain characters. Like, oh, cool.
Yeah, I wasn't in that crossover the way they wrote the Atom. Ryan Choi was just terrible.
Well, I'll have to finish it, but so far it's decente. It's decent.
Yeah.
Um,
So yeah, so the next topic I actually the next two I kind of threw in because I was doing a little too much time on social media. And well, the first one I sort of realized what's interesting about the current phase of Marvel is you see a lot of people complaining about how they feel like it's directionless, and it's kind of annoying because you know they're everyone keeps bringing up Endgame or you know stuff about how previous phases were so coherent in the MCU, and they're forgetting that the whole point of the current phase is to fuck up the status quo, so it's supposed to seem directionless. Like they keep complaining about this phase doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and meanwhile, you know, on the other side of things, the people who are making these movies are beholden to stockholders and are beholden to corporations that are telling them make this tie into different things. So, for example, like right now, the emphasis is streaming. So, you know, a lot of these movies that we're seeing in the theater are sort of half stories. So, like Multiverse of Madness, I was just like, you know, right after I saw it, I kind of texted you, and we talked about it in the episode right after because you saw it before me. But like, I was a little bit disappointed until it came out on streaming. Then I watched like Multiverse of Madness was the culmination. If you watch Multiverse of Madness with WandaVision, you watch WandaVision first, it's one complete story. It's a sub story where, you know, Multiverse of Madness is the payoff of what started in the show. So it's really
Yeah.
tying into the streaming. You know,
No,
hit you in there.
it does. Yeah. That was kind of not obvious to everybody, maybe, but yeah, I kind of saw that.
Yeah. And so yeah, it's like when you watch like and that's when you watch it that way, Multiverse of Madness takes on a whole new dimension. WandaVision provides a little bit of insight into kind of what like some of the things that people were complaining about, what that decision was and why. You know, it's just it's right now we're in a phase where they're building stuff through sub-story and they're building a narrative, but it's gonna seem very directionless because we're at the opening portion. You know, I'm so fucking tired of going on Instagram and for any of these movies and seeing, well, you know, I miss the way I felt at Endgame. Of course you miss the way you felt at Endgame. You know, I look at it in terms of joke setup. I even put this on Instagram. I wrote an entire bitchy post.
When don't
But
you?
almost never, except for there was one time I just put up, you know, thirst trap pictures of different X-Men for anybody's sexual preference. No, so the thing about it was, you know, looking at all these comments about Love and Thunder, comparing it to Endgame, and if you look at everything, if you boil everything down to simplicity, like think of storytelling in terms of joke structure. You know, a joke, you have the setup to the punchline, setup to the punchline. And so in the previous three phases, in phases one, two, three, you had almost, I think, about 17 setup movies to Endgame's punchline. So in joke for like what I said in my post and what I'm saying now is in terms of joke format, if I were to start off a joke, get you all the way to the punchline, and then just stop, you know, there's like it's proven there's like an effect, a psychological effect, and you know, Endgame was like that times 10 because it was like four or five different threads coming together into one culminating massive picture. It's the punchline to 17 other setups. And right now people keep looking at the very beginning of the setup and going, well, I don't like it as much as the punchline. Oh, fucking shit. No, you know,
their opinions towards it, and most people don't see the long pick or the big picture, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Love and Thunder, I guess, before, you know, I'm pretty sure you and I have both seen it, but with all of these things, and in particular the newest installment and the upcoming installments and Ms. Marvel and all of them, like, we live in the age of fast food cinema, and these are fast food films. We're not looking at, like, you know, Godfather or Citizen Kane level filmmaking. We're looking at, you know, popcorn filmmaking, shit that's, you know, made for us to be easily digested and then move on. And in terms of what it's made for, you know, it's a pretty good movie. It's fun. You'll enjoy it if you just go in with you know, the expectation that, hey, I just want this movie to fucking entertain me.
It did. It was hysterical. I loved it, actually. It made me laugh a lot. There was a funny, dumb line.
Yeah. So, you know, it's that's all I'm saying is you don't have to love every single MCU movie. Hell, I've been saying for a while, when everybody was all up on the MCU and all down on DC, I was like, you know, it's not that one set is better than the other. It's that we're watching movies that are moderately okay. And they're all moderately okay. And, you know, everybody's acting like one's so good and one's so bad. And let's be honest, you know, Putin's not the only one with troll farms. Disney has troll farms. AT&T has troll farms. I mean, they have the money for it. What the fuck do you think? They have the money of, you know, their corporations have more money than some countries, you know? So,
yeah, not at all. Way too rich.
They can definitely afford troll farms. They fucking have them. And that's why when people are fucking impressionable. So when you start to see the same comments over and over and over, maybe it's not an original thought. Maybe it's a fucking moron who read something on their favorite news site and is parroting that because, you know, they would prefer to, they're conditioned to complain rather than, you know, just see something at an objective level. I don't know. Maybe well, that's just being conspiracy theorist.
Upon that, we're going to start going through the latest issue we have.
So we're looking at Cable and Deadpool, issue 28, The Domino Principle, part one, for King and Country. This is written by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Patrick Lim, inks by Pete Davidson, colors by Gotham, and letters by VC's Corey Petit. This issue's recap page is presented in a night show format where Deadpool is the host and Domino is the guest.
Much like our last few recap pages with Apocalypse, Deadpool is on the fourth wall thing with the audience while Domino is confused about what is going on. Sounds like movies all the time. She is also dressed in her original early 90s costume, complete with a face framing plate that isn't really a helmet or protective at all, and excessive pouches, straps, and weapons. Since Domino is caught off guard by the fourth wall stuff, Deadpool is the one who tells the audience the salient points of the backstory for the narrative we are beginning today. Cable is the leader of his own island named that is made out of parts of his old spaceship that had blown up in the previous X story. So far, he has been presented kind of like a less dictatorial Dr. Doom or Black Adam. Go the Rock. Deadpool has been sneaking in and out of the fictional nation of Rumekistan.
Mm-hmm.
And Domino has been investigating why he's even doing this. Be good?
I think you're reading the old script.
Am I?
Yeah, I think you're reading the non-edited one. Because certain things are not matching up. You have, like, according to what we are reading here, she has been investigating his activities for a while now. There's been a time skip between the end of the last issue where we saw her team, the six-pack, getting hired. It was just her and GW Bridge with some shady-ass guy. But there's a time skip between then and when we start this issue. But as far as we know, the six-pack is not currently in Rumekistan, as we do not see any of the other members except Domino in this issue. She's the only one. She's the only one who shows up. It's all Domino-centric.
Yeah, I found the other one.
So I still have
3 sentences on them.
Yeah. All right, so Rumekistan was recently taken over by an anarchist enemy of Captain America known as the Flag Smasher. Although this is the same Flag Smasher that many audiences were introduced to in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, you know, the series on Disney Plus.
Lame.
In the comics, Carla Morgenthau is known as Carl, and in the final act of the issue we read for this episode, that's why I knew that, like, when we were watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I knew what was going to happen with Carla before the end of the series, because it was like, oh, I've seen her. I've seen this character before.
And oddly enough, as soon as he was in control of the mechanism, the Black Master did not relinquish the power to establish the contradictory anarchist state of ideology with Jim. Instead, the government he has stood up seems more to be like a liberated or distracting colonial state. While he was loosened the laws related to drugs and alcohol, he also holds regular, non-mandatory political rallies where the attendance is tied to receipt of extra food rations, kind of like the Soviet state. He also has his ultimatum organization that acts as his sort of secret police enforcing his will on the people. Like him.
Yeah, Ultimatum is his group. Like, it's shown up with him before, so it's not like this is in the comics. There, it's not like he just came and then formed the secret police. The Ultimatum Guard was like with Flag Smasher when he was fighting Cap. So, and in fact, the first Ultimatum Guards we see look very much like Hitler's Schutzstaffel, crossed with snowboarders from some wealthy resort type place like Val or Aspen. Like, it's real. SS meets frat boy snowboarder.
Their uniforms are very strict black and white contrast. Their coats, boots, masks, and thigh holster belts are all white with their pants. Turtleneck, goggles, and berets are all black. They really let you know they are better than you. They also have their own coat collar top, which already behaves. It's like that preppy kid from the movies you really wanted to punch.
Exactly. In the opening splash page, Deadpool is taking out at least 6 of these guards that we can see. It's a very crowded image, but we do see his red and black chaos as the focal point of this page, providing a perfect contrast to like the black and white order represented by the secret police that he's fighting. Like, it's very visually striking how, you know, you have Deadpool as like this sort of sore thumb in the middle of these Ultimatum Guards who are clearly meant to enforce something.
Deadpool's work with the Underground Resistance, which we first see here, is the focus. Most of the visual elements of the story, over which are given Domino's narrative, what she's observing in a series of purple-tinted Captain Box. Good color scheme. Everything we see in this issue is from Domino's perspective. We are watching what Deadpool is doing, and we only know what Domino thinks about it as she tries to understand the situation and why Deadpool is even in this country. I can just see a lot of question marks rotating in her head. Since she's an outsider to his intentions, we don't really get to know why he is there until she gains the understanding later in the issue.
And that's sort of a cool thing they do with Domino or with X-Men characters a few times. Like when there's a in the later, I think it's in the Daniel Way run of Deadpool, where Deadpool tries to join the X-Men, and even though you're supposed to be reading a Deadpool comic, just to give you a sense of how chaotic it is, it kind of shows it from the X-Men's perspective. And, you know, so he does a bunch of crazy shit, and then it all comes together in the end. And while he's riding a bus out of town, Cyclops is forced to admit that Deadpool's got some skills.
Oh, that could be the only most painful thing for Cyclops. Ego.
But in this image in particular, the one we're still describing from the first splash page, Deadpool is kneeling on the head and torso of an Ultimatum soldier, like the soldier is a surfboard that Deadpool is going to ride into the other five guards we can see in the image. To give the reader a feel for how many people Deadpool is taking on at once, one of the five guards that we know is there because his leg is running into the frame from the left. His boot is sort of just, all you see is his boot, but you know he's one of the guards scrambling to fight this, you know, crazy force of chaos in red and black. Meanwhile, Domino is ruminating on who stands to gain from the Rumeki resistance movement and Deadpool's support of it. I wonder if it's the same person that it always is in the Cable.
At the same time, we see that Domino's conflicted as she wonders what the length of resistance will accept to achieve their goals, as well as how far she should go to stop them.
As Deadpool continues to kick the shit out of the Ultimatum guard on the next pages, Domino is able to pretty easily work out the answer to her first question,
which was, who hired Deadpool?
And she states that even though Russia, Germany, Latveria, and Iran have a vested interest in what happens in Rumekistan, with three of those nations, the three non-fictional ones, meant to provide you a hint as regarding the approximate location of Rumekistan. It's probably somewhere between Germany, Russia, and Iran, so in that sort of southeast region of Europe, you know, that would make it interesting to those three countries, kind of around where Turkey is.
Like around the Balkans.
Huh?
Like around the Balkans.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
But basically, Domino's saying that none of those nations would actually hire Deadpool at this point, because while we have seen many adventures to the past these storylines, his brand is still toxic, because the world still believes that he killed Cable all the way back in the Burnt Offering storyline and the 30 Pieces of Silver storyline that ran in issues 7 through 12 of Cable and Deadpool, which we covered a while ago.
This means the only person who could have hired Deadpool is Cable. Shocker. Which leaves Domino wondering why Cable wants to remove Flag Smasher from power, as she has no trust for him in the current point of the Marvel continuity. So her level of trust for Cable and his intentions can vary from story to story as we span different eras of their history together.
So while Domino is deliberating, Deadpool takes the communications gear from the fallen Ultimatum soldiers. As she watches him do this, Domino figures the Resistance must be ready to move up their plan if they need to be tapped into the enemy's comms. She follows Deadpool to a district of tenement slums, while also providing the reader with a very basic summary of the history of the resistance movement.
So, according to Domino, they're located in housing built by the former dictator that fell into disrepair as a result of the corruption of the dictator's administration. Domino's indicates that they are mostly the regular people from Mekistan, doctors, teachers, lawyers, and who didn't get treated well by the old boss or the new boss. Black Smasher. It is worth noting that behind Deadpool's actions and Domino's thoughts, we see a lot of background images of adults dealing with watching and protecting drunken children. Oh, that's got to be true. This is hinted to be Flag Smasher's intent with the relaxed alcohol laws. Bastards. Parents and adults who are watching fucked up kids aren't helping to organize plan a resistance to his rule.
So Domino watches as Deadpool hands the comms equipment off to the leader of the resistance movement, which is a history professor named Nenad Petrovic, who was imprisoned when Flag Smasher banned the teaching of history on the basis that it is used to promote misguided nationalism, which is totally not a fascist thing to do. You know, banning learning to protect your rule is totally a good thing and not fascist or authoritarian or fucking ridiculous. Domino makes sure to note that there is no actual record of Petrovic being released from prison. He simply showed up and organized the resistance movement 7 weeks ago.
Ah, interesting. I'm sure that's just a coincidence and won't be relevant at all to the point later on.
Yeah, not in the next issue or anything like that.
Anyways, we shift from Domino watching Death where she decides to get a drink at a local watering can. I would if I was at Bergen. Domino is in the bar staring into her drink when the ultimatum captain comes into the bar to meet her. Much like in any depiction of secret police walking into a place where people gather, when the captain walks in, everybody else in the bar walks out, which is what I would do if Ted also walked out.
This guy in particular is an old friend of Domino's. He's a former mercenary named Michael Straka, who Domino thinks always cared too much for the causes he hired himself out to, which makes her pity him as a failed mercenary. Basically, she says he was trying to be a mercenary, and he had the, you know, in terms of the wartime skills, in terms of the ability to do the job of a mercenary, he could, but he kept failing because he kept caring too much about his causes and fell in line with his causes, and Ultimatum ultimately became, I guess, one of those causes. Domino confronts her friend with the fact that Rumekistan is worse off under Flag Smasher than it was before him, and as a result, in the next panel, she leaves Captain Straka to take his turn, staring into his drink as Domino considers whether she should kill the assassin or the target deserving assassination, which is pretty much, I think, the first time that they mention assassinating anyone in the issue. But guess who the target is?
Meanwhile, Deadpool is talking to Petrovic, who is suddenly leading him to meet with the tech expert he hired to break into the comms at Deadpool School, so they can enact their plan at the Flag Smasher rally in the day. IT guy is none other than Deadpool's old pal, that punk-ass weasel, who pissed Wade off during the best buddy part when he stole the thing that Deadpool was hired to steal and then lied to him about it.
The MacGuffin that Weasel managed to steal was the Dominus objective, a server skeleton key which, coupled with Black Box's mutant ability to access all forms of broadcast communications, like early Wi-Fi, forms Cable's current internet-based telepathy substitute. Elsewhere, we shift over and we get a scene of Prester John and Black Box talking, having a discussion, which provides us with the contextual information about why Cable is using subterfuge instead of direct action in Rumekistan. They have this conversation, but it's wholly unnecessary because, as Domino keeps pointing out, it's what Cable always does. So, as we've been reading this for 28 issues, we've already seen this time and time and time again where Cable prefers to operate in the shadows instead of out in the open. But because they wanted the reader to really know what was going on, Prester John plays dumb, and it's really a waste of a scene. The short answer, again, is that this is what Cable always does and is part of the reason why Domino is so distrustful of him in the issue to begin with. But as Black Box explains to Prester John, the reason for this is that the impact of Cable overtly taking over and deposing Flag Smasher, versus letting the people of Rumekistan remove Flag Smasher and decide to accept Cable's support in the aftermath is going to look different to the international community at large. So essentially we're seeing Cable, you know, imperialize Rumekistan, but he's being subtle about it because of how it plays out in international politics. In other words, he's kind of just becoming another imperialist nation, you know, and ask indigenous people how imperialism works out. Then we get another waste of a scene as Irene is shown giving the scoop about Rebecca Stan to Ken Ellis. You'll remember Ken Ellis as the reporter we met in the issue where Deadpool met his future best buddy Spider-Man for the first time. Then we're finally back to the main story and the reconciliation of Deadpool and Weasel.
As Weasel reveals to Deadpool that he did the time for trying to steal Donna's objective from the RAND Corporation, effectively doing the time for Deadpool as he was hired to steal the same device. Deadpool let him know there is no hard feelings between them by telling Weasel he had recorded all the episodes of Battlestar Galactica that Weasel might have missed while he was in jail.
Since Domino has no trust in Cable, Deadpool, Weasel, or Petrovic for various reasons, she decides to intervene in this exact moment. And by intervene, we mean attack Deadpool by blowing out a wall of the Rameki Resistance hideout, a move which will bring the Ultimatum Guard running, you know, because they're the secret police of the region, and there has been an explosion, thanks to Domino. As the smoke clears and Deadpool sees who is behind the blast, he figures out loud that because of their shared history, Cable probably won't want him to kill Domino, so he puts his guns away and they both draw swords.
Ooh, classic fight. Well, Deadpool draws swords, plural, but Domino takes out a sword, last nightstick combo, for a badass convenient panel, and then they fight. Deadpool has strength, speed, and healing power as a man. The Domino's mutant luck power causes him to fumble about like a stooge and even up the odds. So did he look like... Oh, what's the name of the stooges?
Well, there was, I mean, not a little bit like Larry Moe and Curly, but I was thinking more like, Pat Patterson Curly. And Jerry Briscoe.
I was just thinking Curly.
Oh, no, it was more like Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe, where it was kind of like, you know, as they're getting older and becoming the comedy act in wrestling, they still can throw a punch or two, but, you know, they're mostly, there's a lot of pratfalls and shit like that. So, yeah. It only works for Domino for so long, though, because she starts to lose, as she starts to lose the upper hand, she decides to pull a gun on Deadpool, effectively ending the fight because, you know, he put his guns away to fight her, and then she pulled them out, so she looks like the dick. Visually, there's a cool effect, as earlier in the fight, everything was close up on Deadpool and Domino. Like, even in the panels, we don't see much of a background until kind of around when she pulls the guns. And then, the background opens up, and we see more of the people and the resistance that had been watching the action because, you know, she just blew out a part of their wall. And, you know, so there's a crowd gathering, and what they see is, you know, there's what looks like a pretty fair fight. And then Domino pulls guns, and then the Ultimatum Guard comes and gives her backup. And so as everybody's fleeing, what is now cemented in their mind is Domino is on the side of the Ultimatum Guard. She's against the resistance, which means she's against the Rameki people. Even though she wasn't working with the Ultimatum Guard officially, you know, that the people not fleeing the scene are going to associate her with the soldiers that showed up regardless of whatever the truth is. And that's when she realized she's been played, you know, she's her and guess who she figures played her, and he did, you know, he's gonna, that's the whole culmination of the issue, but we'll get there. As a result, she has literally presented herself to the people of Rameki-Stan as their enemy due to the influence of that shady man behind the scenes, the guy who's going to show up like for a panel and yet be top billed in this on this comic book.
At Flag Smasher's weekly public address rally the next day, when Domino watches this, he continues to yell the same old thing that he's been saying for years, according to her. As she laments the lack of political leaders in the modern era who can be believed in, which is meant to reference her distrust in Cable, as he is one of those political leaders at this point in the Marvel time. Flag Smasher's Mick cuts out and someone begins to address the crowd in the Rameki language. My money's on Jesus.
This fact serves to drive home the point that Flag Smasher is not a fit ruler for the Ramekki people. He's been spewing his rhetoric at the people in English, a language most of them do not even speak, while using a foreign police force to subjugate them to his rule. He's just coming out not looking worse and worse in this shit. That's why, again, I knew what was going to happen to Flag Smasher, but Carla Morgenthau is a lot more sympathetic than Carl Morgenthau. Like, when Morgenthau, what happens to him, you're kind of like, oh, yeah, that's what happens to dickhead dictators. Meanwhile, Domino spies Deadpool on an adjacent rooftop with a sniper rifle and assumes his intentions. As Flag Smasher decides that the people are a threat to him, because his yelling at them in English has been stopped, he demands that Captain Straka fire on the crowd of people while Deadpool and Domino both take aim at their respective targets.
As the crowd looks on in horror, Flag Smasher is shot in the center of his forehead. Ooh. Deadpool and Captain Straka both look at their weapons shocked, with Deadpool stating that he was only supposed to wing the target.
Yeah, I don't understand why Captain Straka looks at his weapon. Like, he... Flag Smasher was ordering him to shoot at the crowd. He didn't shoot at the crowd. Flag Smasher gets shot. And then Captain Straka's looking at his gun like, what? Was I possibly one of the people who did it, even though I did not pull the trigger or aim it at him at all? Like, that part didn't make sense. But Deadpool's looking at his gun, and, like, he was taking aim at Flag Smasher, but he was just supposed to, like, shoot Flag Smasher in the arm, or at least that's what Cable hired him to do. But remember, Domino doesn't trust any of them, so when she sees Deadpool supposedly taking aim to kill Flag Smasher, she kills him first, because that makes sense. I don't trust you to kill, I don't trust your intentions, so I'll do exactly what you are going to do, because if I do it, then I did it. Or something. That's fucking logic for you.
Sure.
Anyway, since her gun is the only one with smoke coming from the barrel, Domino is revealed as the shooter as Petrovic simultaneously jumps onto the stage to introduce the people to their new political leader, the man behind everything they have seen today. Surprise, surprise, it's Cable. As he floats above the cheering crowd, thanks to the cone of silence technology he stole and now uses as a tech-based telekinesis, Domino sets up the next issue by stating she is still on the job. Though what that job is remains unclear, as it seemed like the six-pack was hired in the last issue to stop Cable and Deadpool, and in this issue she did pretty much everything Cable had wanted her to do. Even though she said she didn't trust him, she basically handed him a country. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she definitely did. So, yeah, that is the end of the issue for this episode. Favorite art?
I like the opening splash page because, one, it's a fun Deadpool fight that uses color-based symbolism to foreshadow Domino's internal conflict in the later parts of the issue. Deadpool's bright chaos clashes brilliantly with the black and white order of the Ultimatum Guards, with the strong inclusion of black on both sides of the fight, kind of demonstrating Domino's discomfort with trusting either to make sure what she sees is the right choice for the Ramekki people. And that's the thing, is I don't respect Domino or her choices in this issue, but I do really like how layered the issue is. Even if the logic is stupid, like the logic is straight up stupid, but the layering of the issue and how sort of symbolic certain things are and how they foreshadow other things is really cool to see. And it makes me really enjoy this issue. So I have this weird sort of respect for the issue, complete disrespect for some of the characters in the issue, as you'll see as we go through these parts. But what was your favorite art?
I would probably be more on the actual surprise of who shot.
That was well drawn.
Yeah. And I think it's just a really good shock to everybody as everything's going on. Like you said, it's just kind of a shit show and things are happening. It's like, finally she's like, you know, I'm gonna just take the man and ruin everyone else's plan to do it himself.
But even in those, like the way, like just to give the audience sort of an impression of the sequence you're talking about, you have Domino, like it's a series of images that come sort of quick and fast, and you have Domino seeing Deadpool, both of them taking aim, and then sort of like a quick shot of Flag Smasher running towards Captain Straka to demand he fire on the crowd, and then just a plain sort of plain background, single image, Flag Smasher getting shot, a shot of the people, and then like Deadpool and Captain Straka looking at their guns in another shot, and then a big reveal page where Domino's like looking down on the, you know, from the perspective, you're looking up at Domino, her gun smoking, you're seeing it from sort of the front of the barrel. Like it's really well drawn and it's really well plotted. And I agree, that's really good art.
Favorite part of the story?
So, like I said, as much as I don't respect Domino's choices in this, and as much as I really don't like Cable being an imperialist, I don't really have a favorite part of the story, because I do, like, as a story, I can still get lost in it and have fun reading it. And so even though I do have questions about some of the characters' actions, I do really like this story. So instead of having a favorite part, I have a least favorite part. I hate the context shit part in the middle from Providence. It's really just Prester John being super dense so that he can ask the obvious questions and we can learn the obvious stuff about the story when someone else explains it to Prester John. And seriously, he's still without his stellar rod. And it really doesn't do much to further the story itself. So, you know, lack of stellar rod and the clear phallic symbolism that that represents, and really just him being dumb or seeming dumb and sort of asking questions that anyone could have picked up from context. It doesn't do much to further the story. Could have simply been an off-panel conversation, and nothing would have been lost from the overall story itself. What about you? What was your favorite, or in this case, least favorite part of the story?
No, for me, I enjoyed more of the fact that it's not always this issue in Deadpool's mind. This is part of Domino's reading of how the situation is. That's what I like, because it does kind of leave you kind of going like, what the hell is he really up to? And her own like nervousness and anxiety about what the hell is going on, just that's what made it interesting to me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the lack of stellar art is just hysterical. issue MVP. For me, I'm going to just say quickly, it's Domino.
Wow!
Just because, like, it is funny in the sense that it's from her and just how kind of a shit show she really made it. When this time around is not just Deadpool.
Yeah.
So, that to me.
So, for me, the MVP was Deadpool. You know, even though he was hired to do it, all he does is help the Rumeki people. And he forgives his friend. So he's almost like a real good guy in this issue. You know, he's helping people. He's reconciling with friends and showing us how good forgiveness can be. You know, he's almost like a true hero instead of an anti-hero.
In that episode, like, he'll probably go after he's in the next one.
Yeah.
Shittiest character.
You go first.
On this one, I'll definitely say it's Cable, just because he's literally being Vince McMahon and kind of letting everything happen and just picking up the pieces and strolling right on in like crazy.
So yeah, I agree with you on Cable. I had a tie. My tie is between, you know, your shittiest character and your issue MVP. For Cable, he's basically, like you said, he's Vince McMahon. He's orchestrating the events. He's the invisible hand behind the scenes. He's effectively colonizing Rumekistan for Providence. And you know, he's just being shady, he's just being shitty, and indigenous people all over the world can tell you that this type of action, when someone imperializes, doesn't generally bode well for the people native to the colonized region itself. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a beginning of the end for Cable, without ruining too much of sort of what's going to happen subsequent to this story in this Cable and Deadpool run. My other choice was Domino, as the shittiest character. Yours was the MVP, but I couldn't stand how she took it upon herself to be Flagstaff's judge, jury, and executioner on the reasoning that she is preventing other people she doesn't trust from doing it. I mean, her logic is just completely fucked. She doesn't trust them, so she does what they want for them. And, you know, it'd be like if Verano, you were doing something, you were, I don't know, going to rob a bank, and I said, no, 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 you can't rob that bank. I don't trust what you'll do with that money. So I'm going to rob the bank. What the fuck?
Yeah, I just think that's awesome.
It's so stupid. It doesn't fucking make sense.
That's what makes it great.
I don't trust you I don't trust why you're going to kill this guy. So I'm going to kill that guy, damn it. The fuck? It just doesn't make sense.
I'm understanding more why they act.
Well, I just feel like it demonstrates that her judgment is just as poor as anyone else she's sitting there and judging. You know, she doesn't trust Cable. She doesn't trust Petrovic. She doesn't trust Deadpool. She doesn't trust Weasel. She doesn't trust this. She doesn't trust that. She doesn't trust Mom. She doesn't trust Dad. She doesn't trust the President. She doesn't trust the Pope. I don't give a fuck. She doesn't trust anybody. And so she does exactly what all those other people were going to do anyway, just takes it on her shoulders. It makes no fucking sense to me.
No, but it does make for a great story.
And that's true. I agree. I do like the story. So, you know, we got our new five takeaways segment, and with the Thor movie having been out for a little while, I figure now would be a good time for anybody who's interested in hearing some context, some takeaways from the comic book side of where Gore the God Butcher comes from. Basically, when you know, we heard that this movie was going to be gore-centric, I kind of put a lot of Thor comics from the past 10 years into my Marvel Unlimited queue and just read the shit out of them. I read, you know, what is it? Thor God of Thunder from 2012. I read The Mighty Thor with Jane Foster. I read The War of the Realms. I read King Thor. I read The Unworthy Thor. Basically, like almost any Thor I could get my hands on, I read through the stories, and you know, they were really good. But I mean, you know, the thing is, when people are disappointed with Thor Love and Thunder, I could understand being disappointed if you were looking at the gore that was presented in Love and Thunder and were like, oh, that gore was a pale shade of the nuance of the gore in the comics. That'd be cool. But most of the time people are just like, oh, I didn't like the CGI, or I didn't, they nitpick, and it's all the nitpicking that you can hear when critics are operating off of payola and troll farms. So, you know, it's just, so anyway, all that is to say, when it comes to gore, his main two stories are The God Butcher, which are from Thor God of Thunder issues 1-5. That's the 2012 title. The Thor God of Thunder issue 6, which was not kind of tied into the guy. It was kind of the connective tissue between the God Butcher and the next story, God Bomb, which was the collection of Thor God of Thunder issues 7-11. And then a number of other subsequent Thor comics of the past decade. Basically, you know, what Gore is planning to do, it's kind of like what you see in the movies. But I'll get into that, because that's in my five takeaways. But yeah, it's a good read. So number one for you, Verano, the repercussions from these stories, as in The God Butcher and God Bomb, reverberate in Thor-related comics for the better part of a decade. While he fights Thor, Gore, like, the thing about, and you can back me up on this, Verano, because you've seen the movie. When you watch gore in the movies, his reasoning is pretty simplistic, right?
Yeah, he was betrayed by his own gods and made to feel worse than shit, and so he killed him.
Right. And then does he talk much about why, or does he have, like, big, deep conversations with Thor when he's fighting him?
Not so fully deep.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, is in the in God of, or in the God Butcher and God Bomb, he spends a lot, like, he makes it very clear to Thor why he's fighting him, what his problem with gods are, why he, like, he you know, he makes it clear and sort of says, you know, the gods use us, they're leeches, they're not helping us, they're hurting us, and therefore if I get rid of them, people, normal people like me, will be better off. And it's deeply nuanced because, you know, he just like in the other stories, he comes upon All Black the Necro Sword, becomes almost a god himself, and sort of both sides just, and they really do capture this well in the movie, both sides are able to convince the other and change the other by the end. In the movie, you know, Gore and Thor both have an effect on each other. It's not the same effect as in the comics, though. Because, you know, Thor's own, in the comics, when he's talking about his philosophies, when Gore makes his argument against the gods and their worthiness of the faith of those that pray to them, Thor's own experience with other gods and how selfish the gods that he knows, how selfish they can be, leads him to question whether or not he believes Gore was at least rhetorically right. Not necessarily that Gore should have been killing gods, but that Gore's point about gods being lecherous to the people that they supposedly are supposed to be helping, he starts to feel like, how am I helping people? How is my, like, as I go around in superhero and get to feel like a beloved figure, how am I actually helping these people? But, you know, he can point to instances where even his own actions have hurt people, and it creates this doubt in him. And it is those three words, Gore was right, that Nick Fury whispers into Thor's ear in the moment that Thor lost his worthiness to wield Mjolnir during the original Sin event of 2014. At that time, they're having, like, you know, it's all the Avengers fighting with Nick Fury because Nick Fury killed the Watcher, and all these new things are being revealed. And so to sort of take Thor out of the battle, Nick Fury whispers something in his ear. Now, you don't find out until much later. I think it actually is in a Thor comic where Thor tells someone, you know, they ask, what made you unworthy of the hammer? And then it sort of flashes back to that scene, and it shows Nick Fury whispering, just, Gore was right, in Thor's ear. And Thor gets a wide-eyed expression, and both he and his hammer drop to the moon. And Thor is unable to lift Mjolnir for years. Not until the conclusion of the War of the Realms event of 2019 and like late 2019, early 2020, does Thor even get Mjolnir back. Now, in the movie, when Jane Foster claims, "Oh, I felt Mjolnir call," that is exactly what happens in the comics. But she doesn't just have to go to, like, Townsburg in Norway. She goes all the way to the fucking moon and picks up Mjolnir. And but that part is pretty comic accurate. In the meantime, Jane Foster develops cancer while Thor is losing his worthiness, and then spends some time as the Mighty Thor when she visits the moon after hearing the her. So number two, and these get shorter as time goes on. The first two are like the longest ones.
Yes, but...
So number two, Gore's origin story is oddly similar to a similarly designed DC superhero, Saint Walker of the Blue Lanterns. Do you know who I'm talking about when I talk about Saint Walker?
I actually have part of the series, like the Green Lanterns, where, like, they essentially introduce all the other lanterns. And I do have part of Saint Walker's origins. I do like that lantern a lot. I think he's one of the cooler ones.
I love the way the Blue Lanterns interact with the Green Lanterns, and how Blue Lanterns supercharge Green Lanterns, and Green Lantern, and they need the Green Lanterns around to have any offensive capability to their weapons, because you need hope, you need willpower to enact your hopes. That's all really cool. I mean, seriously, you probably know the origin story of St. Walker too, then, and his origin and Gore's origin are pretty similar up to the point where they get their MacGuffin weapon, you know. Both of these guys come from societies with a strong focus on their religion. Both lose their entire family as a result of either their faith or those that practice the society's faith. Because in the comics, Gore is actually shunned. His whole family dies. It's not just his daughter. Like, he has a wife and other kids in the comics, and they all die too. But Gore and his daughter, after the first part of his family dies, Gore and his daughter are excommunicated, because it's at that point that Gore decides, you know, damn our gods, and gets kicked out of society for blasphemy, and then is in the desert, and then, you know, his daughter dies, and then he comes upon Null, the god of the symbiotes, who has been fighting a different god, and he steals All Black the Necrosword. Now, unlike in the movie, Null's not dead. Null comes back later on in the King in Black storyline, that with All Black again. So, however, they both lose their entire family as a result of the faith of their society, and both come upon MacGuffins that provide them with immense power. St. Walker gets the Blue Lantern Ring, Gore gets All Black the Necrosword. Even with those similarities in their backstories, they also have a similar design. They both have head tendrils, like the Twi'lek of the Star Wars universe, but Gore has two, while Saint Walker only has one, and that's why when people were bitching that Christian Bale did not look like Gore from the comics, I kind of kept thinking, well, no shit, because Disney owns Star Wars and they don't want cross-pollination.
Yeah, I can see them definitely trying to avoid that.
Yeah. Once they get their weapons, the plots of their respective stories kind of twist away from one another, because St. Walker gets the Blue Ring of Hope. Story, like, the reason he loses his family is because their sun is going supernova. It's expanding into a red giant and eventually going to explode. And so, as the ice caps are melting and there's massive flooding on his planet, he and his family try to climb to the top of the tallest mountain, and various natural disasters kill off his family one by one until he gets to the top of the mountain, and his hope that some kind of salvation will come comes in the form of the Blue Ring. And even though he can't get his family back, he, you know, uses the ring to fly up into space. And oddly enough, even though, it's not really an offensive or defensive capability, he just kind of uses the ring's magic to reignite, uses hope and the power of his hope to reignite the star and cause it to have millions in it to save at least his people, if not his family. Who he can't resurrect. However, when Gore comes upon Null, the god of the symbiotes, and another god who Null had been fighting, he steals Null's weapon, All Black the Necrosword, and uses its power to go on a god-murdering spree until he gets an idea to exterminate all gods across time using the God Bomb. And that becomes a really crazy story where Thor, from three different points in his life, come together at one point in the timeline to fight Gore as like a team of Thors, and there's also Thor's granddaughters. And what's really interesting is sort of that whole way that sometimes Marvel likes to tell the story, where the reason the all-powerful character kind of falters is because of inconsistencies in their own mind. So Gore, just like how Saint Walker couldn't resurrect his family, Gore appears to resurrect his family, but they're not true resurrections. Like, there are people who look like his kids and his wife, but they have sort of the touch of All Black like Gore has on them. And you come to realize that they are more aspects of his personality that he's putting into sort of pocket creations. And one of those creations, the one that represents this kid, is convinced to fight against Gore because essentially, you know, they're saying if he hates God so much, why has the Necrosword essentially made him a god? And so it's kind of like that you hate, you become what you hate, and then that tears you apart from within type of story. So that's pretty cool.
Just to throw in, my phone's going to die soon.
All right, so number three, using all black and gore is that provides a lot of implications for the MCU. All black was created by Null, the god of the symbiotes, you know, Venom and Carnage and all that. All black later shows up with Null in the King of Black event of 2020 and 2021, which could imply the doors open to future Sony Marvel partnerships on the Venom side of things. All Black and Gore also play huge roles in the King Thor miniseries of 2019, though it is doubtful we will see the King Thor version of the character in the MCU, just because. On the other hand, I would have said the same thing about Jane Foster's Mighty Thor 2 years ago, so I could be wrong on this one too. Number four, we meet the goddesses of thunder in these storylines. They will probably continue to show up in any Thor stories that interact with his future self. Especially as we have seen him become the young King Thor in the conclusion of the War of the Realms. And the way you can tell King Thor is missing an arm and an eye. You know, he in the War of the Realms, he finds out that the new seed of the World Tree has been planted in the sun. And so where Odin crucified himself on the World Tree to gain the knowledge of the universe, Thor does it while also facing the burning torture of the sun. And just as Odin traded his eye to do so, so does Thor, and essentially becomes the new Odin in a way. In the gore-related comics, Thor is shown at three stages of his life that all eventually individually transcend time to band together and fight Gore as a team. His youthful phase, where he was not yet worthy to yield Mjolnir and thus used an axe called Yarnborn. His then current age in Marvel continuity, and then his millennia older King Thor phase that has ascended to Odin's throne as the Allfather of Asgard. The King Thor version has three granddaughters, Frigg, Atli, and Elisiv, who all play a large part in helping their grandfather thwart Gore's plans. But I understand why we didn't see them in Love and Thunder. Spoiler alert, you will daughters in Love and Thunder.
That's a shame. I think that'd be great.
Last takeaway, we all know that Jane Foster is in Love and Thunder, but she does not play a part in the God Butcher or God Bomb, though what happens in these stories directly lead to her time as the Mighty Thor, and in the movie it's kind of referencing her time as the Mighty Thor, although when she was the Mighty Thor she had a lot more adventures than just one. And And just for those of you who have seen the movie, I will say that Jane Foster's story has a happy ending in the comics. She does have the cancer. She does succumb to the cancer after fighting the Mangog. But when she actually, that's when Thor tells her not to pick up the hammer again. She does it one more time while going through, while in the War of the Realms, and does die. But at that time, Odin and Thor give Jane Foster defibrillation via Mjolnir, which is revealed to have been like the god of storms, coalesced into one hammer. And so they give combined Odin force, god of storms, defibrillation to Jane Foster's body. So she gets pulled back from Valhalla. And an alternate universe, Mjolnir disintegrates into a wristband that then gives her the power of the Valkyrie. And so she comes back to being a full-on medical doctor with Valkyrie powers. So
nice.
That is our fifth takeaway, Jane Foster's role in sort of how the God Butcher and God Bomb relate to her becoming Thor, less her being a sort of. There's just a kind of mashup in the movie, but it's cool because they can't, like, if you think about how the stuff plays out overall, they can't do that in the movie. They can't do the stuff from the comics and the movies. They just can't. So it makes sense. This podcast for our closeout is not even listener supported. We do this out of the kindness of our hearts because we really enjoy comics. But, you know, we would someday love the opportunity to try to sell you shit that you had no idea you didn't even want. And what that would require is for more people to listen. So if you get the chance, you know, next time you're in a public restroom, maybe you have your keys, maybe you have Sharpie. But, you know, just write the name of the podcast on the wall and encourage people to listen. And maybe, you know, some people who have the moral turpitude to read shit on a public restroom wall and actually follow through on it, which would be about the right amount of morals to really get into our shit show. You know, just spread the word that way. But yeah, if we can build up our listener base, get to about an average of 50 listeners, then Anchor will give us the chance to sell you crap. And we would love to be able to do that, to be able to keep the podcast free, but also maybe squeeze some blood out of the stone.
Yes. So please pass the word. We will listen as well. And listen. I hope you guys see us next time.
See ya.